Hey, you're listening to Sup Doc, a podcast about documentaries.
That's right, and I'm Puck Romaine.
I'm George Chen. We asked Sam McPheeters, musician, writer, novelist, and he chose a very bizarre movie for a guy who's known for being in bands like Born Against and Men's Recovery Project. He went for Samsara.
Yeah, and it was a great pick. I love Samsara. I've seen it a bunch, and it was great to see it again. And it's in that classic kind of Baraka style and theme where it's just like different disparate amounts of video footage kind of threaded together with this overall arching theme. It's incredible.
Yeah, they shot it on 70mm film, so it's gorgeous. The colors are outstanding. And Sam's a real interesting guy, so you're going to really hopefully enjoy this episode with Sam McPheeters talking about Samsara.
Sam on Samsara.
Sam, welcome. And am I right? Did you used to work in a video store for a while?
Yeah, I worked in a video store 8 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was there, I made a list of all the movies that I had not seen that pissed off customers. So I hadn't seen Jaws. And people got...
they were mad at you for not being...
For not seeing Jaws. At a video store. Shouldn't have worked at a video store right. If I hadn't seen Apocalypse Now.
I had the same problem with Star Wars. I didn't grow up seeing Star Wars. And then I just saw it about 10 years ago, Star Wars. And I used to get so much shit for that.
That's odd.
But you saw the... exactly. Hopefully the original cuts, right? Not like the George Lucas... well, you probably don't know what you saw, right?
I don't know what I saw, no.
If it looked CGI, then...
Yeah.
I mean, there's CGI, but it's a different generation of CGI. That was
yeah. I didn't see it like a lot of people my age where they're little kids and got to go to the theater and stood back in line, you know.
Was that because of a religious reason?
That was because of religious reasons.
Which religion?
Christianity.
Oh, okay.
But mid-Michigan Christianity, which is like, hell and high water, like, put your hands up to God and shake your tongues a little bit.
Star Wars was just too much.
Too much Satan stuff.
Too far beyond. There is a lot of Satan in Star Wars, and I remember being shocked by that as a child.
You mean in terms of Darth Vader stuff or Empire
just
stuff?
Just Satan.
Or? Just Satan.
He knows.
Just Satan in general.
I didn't grow up with like a lot of the Satan stuff, so I was afraid of alien abduction, so Star Wars should have been more freaky.
We couldn't say geez because it was half of Jesus. That's where my family, that's where we were. In that.
Us and Jesus, yeah.
But speaking of Satan, Samsara, what a documentary.
Well, speaking of Satan, it's not overtly Christian, or it's not overtly any particular. Is it
or
Buddhist?
Is it
Samsara? Is like
oh, it's Sanskrit, right?
For those of you who have not seen it, I'm assuming half the people that listen to our thing haven't seen the movie. Ron Frick is a director. He also made Baraka. Looks like he worked on Koyaanisqatsi as a producer.
He was a cinematographer on Koyaanisqatsi, which means. He obviously had a lot of control over what that movie became, but didn't shape the direction of it. Mm-hmm. Koyaanisqatsi, when I first watched Samsara, I watched it for the third time last night, just to kind of refresh myself. When I saw Koyaanisqatsi, I don't know what year it came out, but I feel like I was in high school.
Or 88?
Yeah. Maybe in college. It kind of turned me off. It's such a beautiful film, but it's so bombastic. And they're making a point that's really weird, that life is out of whack, and it's very new agey, and it's very blunt with that. And my take on that was, if you really feel that way, don't have an artistic response. Like, go engage the world somewhere instead of striking a pose in front of it with your beautiful movie. I expected Samsara to be that, and it really wasn't. It looks... better because of the technology, and I think this was shot on 70mm.
Yeah. They make a point of it in the trailer that 70mm.
Yeah, Baraka, I don't know if it was. Baraka, I rented it, my first and only Blu-ray. I was really excited to try out this Blu-ray player we got as a wedding gift, and it locked up 10 minutes in, and I was just so furious. Oh. I'll watch digital stuff or VHS, but I don't like watching DVDs because that happens to me all the time. When I rented movies at the video store, the one perk of working at a fucking video store is you get free movies, and half the movies would freeze up, and it just didn't seem...
Where was the video store?
In Claremont, California.
Oh, Claremont.
So I'm from inland. I'm from Pomona. Claremont's a couple more exits down the freeway. Far, far east of here. If we go to a movie at the Egyptian, we know we're not going to be on time, and that's...
That's just how it is.
That's what you get for living in Pomona with the Hicks.
So what did you think of Baraka then?
The 10 minutes I saw were great. Right. But they're colored by rage
at
my machine.
Oh, right. It sucks, man. I remember getting a brand new Blu-ray player and having to put some books under it to make it a 45-degree angle so that it could work.
I don't even still understand exactly, like, Blu-ray. The idea is that you can have, like, all the DVD extra type things, but they can be updated. Like, they actually, like, call to some kind of... They get online or something.
Yes.
Like, what kind of extra information are they going to add to Baraka?
There's things you download. Yeah,
dead
I don't
guy
know.
Is still dead.
No, the idea is that the Blu-ray technology itself, you're supposed to be able to take a screwdriver to a Blu-ray disc and not damage it.
Yeah.
Oh. And this was a brand new disc. I think it was the first rental on a brand new player. And I don't want to be turned into one of those people that complains about things like that in a podcast like I'm doing right now. And so I just don't rent things for it. I will gladly watch a VHS tape. I've had one VHS malfunction on me in all my many years of watching VHS tapes.
I used to love laser discs.
They're so heavy.
I love some laser discs.
You can get stuff. There's stuff that's on laser discs that never got reissued on DVD for sure. There's a lot of like classical stuff and opera stuff. When you were working at this video store, were you watching many documentaries? Would you just throw a documentary on in the background?
In the background, yeah. There were a lot of movies I absorbed by osmosis, meaning I would hear it for five times over the course of one day, but could only watch certain segments of it. Documentaries, we must have played a lot. The only one I can remember is The Bridge, that suicide documentary. Oh. We had a very strict list of what we couldn't play from management, which makes sense because there's a lot of movies that aren't appropriate if a child walks in. Yeah. The Bridge totally is not on that list ever.
Even though it's not appropriate for children.
No, I'm saying The Bridge will never be appropriate to play in that store. And so me and my coworker were unhappy one day and we said, let's put on The Bridge. And everything stopped. Like it's a very, I don't remember there being any sound. And it was just footage of someone walking on the bridge and all the customers stopped and they stared up and it was so awful and just soul deadening. And so we just, we couldn't get back to the player behind the counter fast enough. The first body was already falling. And then put on Dumbo, which was also the wrong choice. Dumbo, I used to watch. I would watch Dumbo for 2 weeks after 9/11 because I needed something to just make myself weep for 10 minutes. And so I can't see the credits of Dumbo without getting really fucked up emotionally. Robert Stack in 1941, there's a scene where he takes like half of his platoon into a theater in Los Angeles to watch Dumbo, and they show him, and he's just sitting there in the audience weeping. That would be me just during the credits. And so those were already two strikes.
What was his preeminent role, Robert Stack? What was his...
I have no idea. I want to say Dragnet, and it's not Dragnet.
It's some cop thing.
It was something awesome.
Yeah, it was.
Where I saw him, I was like, fuck Robert Stack. He's awesome.
He was like a man's man kind of Hollywood guy.
I wish he was my buddy instead of a skeleton somewhere.
I mean, I remember the two crows in Dumbo being pretty racist.
Those two crows had nothing on the shit that I just saw at the Egyptian. Vicious, vicious, and just weird silence and titters from people in the audience. Mm-hmm. You know, the best audience ever, I was privileged enough to go to maybe half a dozen movies on the base of Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. I was dating someone who had an officer in the family, and so we were allowed to go on base. And the audiences that we saw, The Professional, and there's a scene where they're bringing out the guns. It's just French guy whose name I know.
Luc Besson.
But I'm on a podcast and can't remember. He just brings out the guns. And people stood up, standing ovation. The guy next to me stood up just like rigid at attention, points, and goes, that's superior firepower.
Nice.
Hoo-ahs.
Hoo-ahs. You got some hoo-ahs.
Yeah. Later. A year later, maybe, we saw The Birdcage with Robin Williams. Yeah. That's not an appropriate movie to play in that venue. And there's one kiss, like, by 2015 standards, a little peck, just boop.
Yeah.
And I thought there was going to be a riot. People were, and this isn't, I'm not exaggerating anything. This, people were screaming. Wow. Like they were watching an ISIS video, standing. You know, the beginning of 1984, video. The one with John Hurt, the very beginning of it, where they're showing people watching the propaganda videos and just screaming blindly at the screen. It was that. It was the scariest experience I've had in a theater.
Weird booking. Bird
have
cage.
You, yeah. Now, Sam, you've done You've done a lot. You're a musician, journalist, novelist. Have you ever made a documentary? Have you ever made a film? I mean, with all the stuff you've done?
No.
Have you ever wanted to?
If I ever found the right idea, I'd be interested. Yeah. One of the things I was considering about today, Samsara is not, I like it a lot. It's not, I can't say it's one of my absolute favorite films. My two favorite documentaries are Sans Soleil by Chris Marker, which I just think would be weird to talk about in this setting. And also, I did some events where I introduced Repo Man because I wound up writing the liner notes for Criterion.
Oh, you did.
And so I wound up becoming a guy qualified to talk about this, which is strange.
Wow.
And cool. That's fun, but it's weird standing in front of people, especially people younger than me, and telling them that something's an important movie. That made me feel a little uncomfortable. And that's what talking about a Chris Marker movie would be, I think. I mean, if you like it, awesome. And if you don't, I totally respect that. Mm-hmm. The other movie... documentary that I love is The Filth and the Fury by Julian Temple.
Right, this is Sex Pistols?
Yeah, the Sex Pistols film. Okay. Yeah. And I would be fine talking about that, except that I don't want to talk about music stuff right now. And there's so much music stuff, and people are so insane over anything with the word punk in it. And that just creeps me out.
It is a weird time for, like, reevaluation. Like, actually, even, like, we know the episode we just aired with Adam like got the most hits of any episode we've had so far, and like it's some of it's just
it's gonna be nothing nostalgia. Compared to this episode.
Yeah, punk nostalgia is like definitely all over right now. I guess it's everyone being in this reflective period, or it's just that it was one of the last things that wasn't super well documented at the time, like because it was all like stuff that was like
I have to disagree with you on that. I think there is nothing that has been more documented than punk and, my God, American hardcore. How many times I've heard people writing books and articles contacting me about, they want to interview me about Born Again stuff, and I feel like I try to be extremely polite, and I just say, look, I wish you the best of luck on this project. I am not being sarcastic as I say that. I genuinely wish you the best of luck, but, like, I don't agree with your premise, which is that what you're doing is underdocumented. Because word for word, all these people say the same thing, which is that this is something underdocumented and we have to preserve the history. And my God, what has been more documented than American hardcore and punk? And just like let it fucking sit for a couple generations or 100 years or something.
You know it's bad when Urban Outfitters has like Sex Pistol t-shirts and you know that. And also now the Sex Pistols have a Visa card.
Is that true?
Yeah. Never mind the interest rates. It's like, never mind the Bullock's credit card.
That makes me really happy.
Yeah. So there you really go.
Happy. The Sex Pistols movie is just an incredibly well-done documentary. There's one or two flaws in it. There's one or two things where he skips that are jarring only because it's so beautifully done the rest of the way through. And I could talk for hours about that, but it really doesn't seem appropriate right now.
Well, like, I mean, I get what you're saying. Like, in a way, like, music documentaries, we haven't done too many of them yet, but there's like it just turns into even the Iron Sheik I felt was just like turns into a fluff piece. There's like not a lot to really
well, that was made by people who were his handlers in order to get him more money, so they, you know, it was like this nice circle of,
I mean, I feel like there's like a difference between something like it's a live concert footage versus something that is trying to lionize people and this, I mean, has anyone tried to do a Born Against documentary? Have they talked to you about that?
Like, no. I know they're doing some... There's been some talk about ABC and Rio documentaries. Born Against was not that big a band to warrant a documentary or anything but inclusion in a book. Mike McKee did one book that has a chapter on Born Against, and that seems like that would be, at best, the appropriate length of time. Good guy, but I said the same thing to him that I said to other people. Like, I don't agree with your premise. Wish you the best of luck on this. Have fun.
Can you give or at least myself and whoever's going to be listening to this, a brief synopsis of Born Against?
Born Against was a crazy wackadoo style hardcore band I was in from 1989 to 1993. We were good at angering people, which is what we wanted to do as a musical hardcore band. It was pretty good. I was not a great performer all the time. Me and other people in that band, most but not all of the people, had very, very serious personal issues There was a lot of pretty bummerific mental illness stuff going on at the time, especially with me. And when you explain that to people now, then you got to parse it out more like, hey, I was really crazy when I was doing this. Not like, man, I was crazy when I was a kid, but more like, yeah, I was really crazy in that I spent a lot of time crying. I had crippling panic attacks. I made a lot of very seriously bad decisions with my life. And some of that is not stuff I totally want to talk about. So we have persisted a little bit as a band from that period, but we were a retro band, which is something that has kind of got lost in the shuffle. That whole ABC No Rio crowd, there were some really good bands that played there. Citizens Arrest were one of the best live bands I've ever seen. But all those bands were retro. That wasn't a scene that rewarded innovation. It was a band that wanted to be a scene from 10 years earlier, which is like, I don't know if you say like, man, I love the rock from the early 50s. Man, I love Stray Cats. Like, no. Like, Stray Cats are great.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, they're a band from the 80s. And Born Against was not an 80s hardcore band. And maybe, I think at the time, there was the feeling that we could have been grandfathered in a little bit because we played five shows in 1989, and that's not the case. So Born Against is this thing that's kind of followed me for most of my adult life, which is mostly a strange curiosity. It's not something I would complain about, but it's kind of like, it's not even like you were a star football player in high school. Like, it's that experience, but one more step. Yeah. Like, man, I can't believe that time that you streaked out at the football game and you had feces rubbed in your hair. That was crazy. And then you'd be like, well, I was having a lot of problems in my life, and my family was murdered, you know, so I was pretty upset. No, man, that was awesome. Talk about that. You're like, well, okay.
Whatever, that sounds fine.
I mean, you've done a lot of you did a couple other projects, obviously. That was a long time ago at this point. I was telling him about the Donahue thing is on one of the records.
Oh, yeah. That was just literally, I called in and got on and just blabbed and made up a bunch of malarkey, and it got on the air. And we bought the tape. The tape was $40. Isn't that weird? $40 to buy a cassette tape. $400 for videotape.
Whoa. Oh, like a transcript of the show?
Of just the show itself.
$400 for a videotape.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
In that era, yeah, that's even like, that's like a grand or something, yeah. But, let's get into Samsara. What made you choose this movie?
Well,
other than I asked you to choose a movie.
You know, I only watch movies with my name in it. Did I not say that in the email?
Oh, we should have booked Sara to do this one also.
Samsara, Seven Samurai, I Am Sam.
Summer of Sam,
yeah.
Yeah, oh.
I was on a flight once,
McFeeters.
And I looked up, I didn't have my glasses on, and they were showing a movie, and it said, I Am Shit. And my first thought wasn't, that's not a movie. Instantly, I jumped to, they can't show that on a plane.
Right, yeah.
And then I put my glasses on, and it's I Am Sam. I saw my own name as the word shit.
that's deep.
So we could also have done Nanny McPhee if this was not.
There's a lot of ways you could have gone. Nanny McPhee ruined my life for about 3 weeks.
Oh, because like,
I don't know. Yeah, it was bad. Samsara, I put on going through the Netflix queue maybe last year out of boredom. Netflix movies really are just dog shit. It's shocking how awful the selection is on there.
Yeah.
Observation, not complaining. 10 years from now, when you can watch any movie, anytime, anywhere, this will all be a chuckle to everyone. I saw Samsara, and my first thought was, that's probably some hippie bullshit. Mm-hmm. I have a strong aversion to that aesthetic of Koyaanisqatsi, even though I really like Koyaanisqatsi, love the soundtrack, the Philip Glass, that really haunting score that he did, put it on and was just mesmerized. It's a non-linear, non-verbal film made by this guy, Ron Frick.
Ron Frick, yeah.
And there is a little bit of connection, and there are some themes that are sort of explored, but mostly it's just random shots. And it seemed to me, watching it that first time, that it was this very concise distillation of God, when you're on a fucking podcast, every word sounds wrong. That's a word, right?
Distillation is
a word.
Okay. And you're using it correctly.
I feel like I'm watching a transcript of myself talking and trying to edit it.
You're doing great.
A very concise distillation of what you're supposed to do as a writer, which is you show, you don't tell.
Show, don't tell.
And he's just showing shit in a really beautiful format. He's obviously this incredible cinematographer on par with other cinematographers that I really like. And it really affected me in this weird way. Then I watched it again in March. So a couple months ago, my wife and I went on a trip through the Southwest and we visited Monument Valley, where all the great John Ford films were shot. And I now, having lived a normal life, have had some experience with prescription opiates. I'm phrasing this very carefully. I have been a teetotaler pretty much all the way through, but I've had a string of root canals, had some minor hand surgery, a lot of chronic neck pain from a pinched nerve, and I was not doing well that night. So I took a Vicodin, sat out on the porch of this cabin we rented that's right there. You're looking out on the buttes of Monument Valley, and I thought, well, I'm going to, you know, what could I do that would be really fun? And so I started watching The Interview, that Seth Rogen movie.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not good.
No, it's not.
I had it on my little iPhone. And then I thought, well, what would it be like to see Samsara on a little teeny tiny screen? Because I watched on my TV and I have a normal American television, which in 2015 means it's really big.
Mm-hmm. And flat.
And flat. And I watched on this little teeny tiny iPhone screen and it affected me just as deeply. And the buttes are right there, like silhouetted against the sky. Mm. And I was like maxed out on my capacity for joy. I couldn't get any, like, I just felt like I was an angel.
Nice.
And so last night, long after I'd committed to doing this episode, I thought I should probably watch it again and make sure that it was the movie.
Because
last time was a little weird. Because I was really, I couldn't sleep later that night because I was just so happy to be alive and that other humans were on the planet with me, and I saw this great movie. It totally held up last night. I was just going to kind of skip through it and take some notes, and I still feel the same way. It's a weird movie. It's not just in that it's doesn't have a point, and it's it's non-verbal, non-linear, but also it doesn't have an agenda, which I think is kind of important, especially in the current documentary climate. I don't watch a lot of documentaries, but I have Netflix, so I've seen some. I watched Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead a while ago, Queen of Versailles.
Good one.
I've seen more than my share of Michael Moore documentaries.
The daughter just died from Queen of Versailles. They're a teenage daughter.
Right, yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
How?
They didn't say yet. They haven't said.
That's an interesting film.
It was just last week. That's a well-made film. I agree, yeah.
Especially in that the people, the guy, he's fucking horrible as a human, and they make him out to be a person, and I thought that was kind of nice.
They humanize him. Yeah,
he is just a little pap smear of just scuzz someone's shoe.
He's the guy that said if the American Care Act got passed, that he would fire employees instead of having to pay for their health insurance, which wouldn't have done any. I mean, he wouldn't have had to pay much, you know, in order to do that. But he was steadfast in firing all of his workers. And then it comes to find out that he just lost, you know, his entire empire of hotels. And
He's terrible, which means that he would be a very easy target. And I admired the fact that they didn't take that route.
Yeah.
I really respond negatively to people that take cheap, lazy shots, especially in documentaries, especially if they're on the same side of the political fence as me. The best example I can say is Michael Moore. I loved Roger and Me. I think that's a really well-made documentary. Yeah. It's just solid. Mm-hmm. I don't care that he kind of played with the facts a little bit. Every other movie he's made, especially Bowling for Columbine, has really pissed me off because it's just, he's just a shoddy, shitty filmmaker. And he contradicts himself. And I don't care. Like, if you fudge political stuff, I'll give you so much leeway if you just deliver the goods. Mm-hmm. And he just doesn't deliver the goods anymore. And I think that's a really that's a very serious sin in his line of work. Mm-hmm. Samsara goes in the other direction. It doesn't It doesn't have an ideology to push. It doesn't really... It's engaged in the world completely, and at the same time, it doesn't have any skin in the game. Is that a real phrase?
That is a real phrase.
It doesn't have any skin in the game. So, for example, that Chris Rock Good Hair documentary. Yeah. I like that a lot, but I walked into it with very low expectations. Right. I don't think it's an amazingly made movie.
No.
One of the reasons I liked it is because I didn't know. Like, I don't know. I didn't know what a weave is. I get it that the people... Some of the people involved in the movie and just were pissed off because they were treated as anthropological subjects. And just in general, if I were a black woman, I might be a little weirded out by that. But so what? You know, I'm not. I come at it from my perspective as a white guy, and I got something out of that movie. It's not a beautiful, like if you look at it, you're not thinking, oh, that's a visually beautiful movie. But it has certain points to make it, and it's entertaining. This movie's the opposite of that. This movie strictly just wants to show you things. And I think if you deliver the goods, then that's some kind of admirable.
I will say, though, I feel like there has to be some sort of agenda involved. Not saying it's political or ideology. However, they edited their footage for a certain reason, which means
there must be some sort of...
It's not like a subtle movie. You know, it's like...
Well, here's what's interesting. I think it is kind of subtle, but I get it that it's very open to interpretation. In reading reviews of it, different reviewers said wildly different things about it. And the SF Gate, which is what? Is that a weekly?
That's actually the Chronicle's website.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Just call it SF Gate. Why not Chronicle?
Just to confuse me personally.
Yes.
It's because of Golden Gate Bridge, yeah.
They said what you're saying.
Yeah.
That it's blunt, and they make this... They really hit you over the head with this, which I thought was interesting, because I didn't get that at all, having seen that three times. I sort of understand how someone would come to that conclusion, but I didn't.
There's certain cuts that make me think that, like, specifically, like, here's some pig carcasses, here's some women in bikinis, here's a bunch of bullets, here's a horribly maimed veteran.
Yeah, there's a few of those shots.
Felt like that.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, all the stuff that was just, like, the first chunk that's just all nature and, like beautiful mountains and time-lapse, they make a big deal, I think, of the time-lapse technology. I guess he did a specific kind of time-lapse technology.
Yeah, I'm wondering if he's the first person to do that. I've seen that technique in some other movie recently, and I just don't know what it is, but it's where they're using just like kind of a straight dolly shot chronologically, where it's over the course of 24 hours.
Yeah.
So they're moving through space and time, and it's a really bizarre effect.
It's really bizarre and really intriguing. I love it, actually. Yeah. I actually watched Samsara this afternoon to brush up as well. And every time they had that beautiful straight dolly shot, I just love it. Like even in the Japanese subway system.
Those are actually really gorgeous.
Yeah. And in the little valleys of the Grand Canyon and mm-hmm. through those, you know, all that stuff is so beautiful.
There's so much going on. I sort of chunked it into there's stuff that's like, here's beautiful nature, here's like mortality and death, here's, you know, not political things per se, but just like humanity's foibles or humanity running out of control. I was going to say that I did just look up that he does have a writing credit on Koyaanisqatsi. And in addition to an editing credit and a cinematography credit. So I'm not seeing Koyaanisqatsi, but I did go to this talk because Philip Glass was going to be there, and I didn't realize it was going to be Philip Glass and the guy who made Koyaanisqatsi, Godfrey Reggio. And I like even took notes and stuff, and I didn't really care for Godfrey Reggio. Like I thought he was super pretentious and like really... Philip Glass was very like... He was pretty like... whatever he said was still interesting, and he was just like, well, you know, I just was going along with Godfrey's vision and things like that.
I've heard him on the radio, and he is disappointingly nice.
Which guy? Oh, Glass?
Philip Glass.
Yeah, yeah.
He just seems like the hell of a nice guy, and part of me wants him to just be like, wow. It's like more like, oh, God, Lou Reed. Just the way Lou Reed would talk. Like, Lou Reed delivered the goods.
My week is better than your year. Yeah.
Such a fucking villain, you know?
Yeah.
Philip Glass totally seems like someone's cool dad.
Ira Glass's uncle, apparently.
Yeah.
Or so cool grandpa at this point.
Yeah.
Oh, Philip Glass. Yeah.
Yeah. But this guy, Reggio, I mean, my understanding is, so that cinematography and that time-lapse stuff was probably an invention that they put together.
Yeah.
It looks beautiful. The colors are amazing. That first scene, I think
the bookend of the whole Samsara film is these monks doing this really intricate
sand.
Yeah, sand art, which is like this crazy geometric pattern thing where they're like crumbling up these colored stones or something into powder and just like layering them. Like it's like kind of like airbrushing, but just like super, super intricate and super like detailed work.
I was actually going to look up exactly what that process was, what the meaning was, what the context was, so that I could talk about it intelligently here in this room. And then I thought, I'm not smart enough to pull that off. Yeah. So I don't know what it was he was showing. I looked up some of the stuff in the movie because I was curious. Like, for example, the miners. It turns out that's a sulfur mine in Indonesia, which was also one of the five subjects of a 2005 documentary whose title I don't remember, but just about people being destroyed through
horrific
jobs. Yeah.
Well, the sulfur mining thing. That was, I'm trying to remember what that followed. It might have followed some other like dismemberment thing or some other like the bullets and things like that. I'm trying to remember what order that
It's so hard to remember the order of Samsara. I keep trying to, and I can never remember. That for me, like I read an LA Times review of Samsara, and they call it frustratingly beautiful because it's obviously a very beautiful movie, but you kind of want to know where you're at.
Yeah. Man, it is not frustrating if you are high as shit on Vicodin and your neck no longer hurts, and you're in Monument Valley, and you love the universe.
Amen.
Like, all those pixels are, like, this big, for you.
Oh, my God.
No, but actually, in the DVD extra, like, there's a second disc, and if you get it on DVD, I recommend getting on DVD, because there's a bonus disc, and he talks about it, Frick talks about it as, like, that's the bookend of the film, is there's this really intricate, monks doing this powder art, and then the end is they just crossed through the all this labor that had to take days and weeks possibly to make, and they just like, okay, we're done with it.
It's love it.
And they wipe it out.
I love
it. And like that is the other thing that he says in the extras is he thinks of it as a guided meditation, which I'm like, there's some real bummer trip outs in that guided meditation in my mind.
It's really weird to me that I hadn't realized until I read reviews and also comments. I went on Amazon and read all the one-star comments for this.
One stars?
Yeah, there were a lot. There's a lot of comments in general.
That's an interesting
And
thing.
Some of the people just said, this movie's stupid. There's no...
Of course.
What's the plot?
Yeah.
Totally valid, even though I depicted them in that weird voice. But a bunch of people said I was so bummed out by the animal stuff that I turned this off. And it's strange to me that hadn't occurred to me, and I watched it last night with a friend. So for anyone listening to this who hasn't seen the movie, there's a scene where they show a factory farm with chicks, and they're getting sucked up by this huge machine. It's kind of like a weird vacuum cleaner type thing. It's doesn't seem appropriate for a living being, and then they're blown into these huge carrier cage things. That reminded me a bit of Terminator Salvation when they stuffed all the humans in those cages.
Or Battlestar Galactica, the 70s version. They would keep human bodies in these weird shelves.
I don't remember that. And so it's a bummer, but it's not. You're not seeing animals get killed. It's not the scene in whatever the hell it was with Pets or Meat, the Michael Moore thing where the rabbit gets killed on screen.
I will say Baraka has a more brutal version of the chicken thing.
It does. Yeah. But they're searing the chick beaks.
They're cutting
and
the beaks.
Oh, yeah.
In Baraka, and it's a close-up, and you see like the bird like wincing.
Right.
Yeah. And they're chicks. Yeah.
There was the person I watched it with last night got really bummed out and emotional, and suddenly I had to think, like, am I a sociopath? Why did this scene never... Why
I think you're a realist,
not
personally.
...affect me? You know what? We, went to... The Marionettes, Bob Barker's Marionettes, which is in Los Angeles. Have either of you been to that?
Anything.
You need to go.
What is this? Like a recommendation. Let's ask.
Mr. Barker died, so these Marionettes, this theater is not going to be around forever. And anybody who's listening to this who's in Los Angeles needs to go. It's just full-on old-timey 1970s-style Marionette show. It was featured in one of the Dr. Steve Brühl episodes. Check it out. Okay. Where he goes and gets scared of the puppets and starts screaming. When we went there like 2 months ago, me and some friends, Eric Anderson was there and my friend Zach, halfway through the show, an old man sitting across this theater space from us basically has a heart attack. He just collapses. Oh. I took CPR for these types of situations. I want to save someone's life. Yeah. I want that on my record so I can go and be a dick for the rest of my life.
Right, that will get you there.
And I remember seeing this, and I was like, huh. And then I turned back to watch the puppet show, and Zach Carlson, like, ran to save the day. And I totally, my first response was like, that's weird. Old man dying. Cycle of life. What you gonna do? And this was kind of the same thing, watching these little chicks get sucked into the chicken vacuum.
Yeah.
Just like, huh, that's weird. So I don't know if I've gotten older or if that part of my brain has died. It was a really scary realization last night that
Did you know he was dying of a heart attack, though? Or
He didn't die. He made it out of the theater alive.
Zach did CPR on him?
It turned out the woman sitting next to the guy conveniently was a paramedic.
Jeez.
You know what? Which was my first response. Like, someone's probably a paramedic. They don't need old Sam McPhee messing around with his CPR training. Someone's going to be in it. Let's get back to the puppets, guys.
And then Zach Carlson just like, I'm going to take care of business. I'm going to leave.
Yeah, he totally...
Well, good for
he
Zach.
Totally just like stepped up. It was a weird moment in my life.
By the way, was he jealous that you did the Repo Man thing, or is that more of his?
Zach got me the job.
He
got the job.
Repo Man. Zach is also the programmer for Alamo Draft, or was the programmer for Alamo.
Yeah, he's not there anymore, but he was have been the best programmer they ever had.
Did you do something for his book, the punk book that he wrote?
No, I mean, I reviewed it. I reviewed it in a book for him.
He has a book that is all about punk in cinema in throughout the 70s.
They watched 20,000 movies over the course of 7 years.
I think I've seen that.
Yeah.
And they have reviewed every single appearance of every punk rocker in every film of the 20th century.
Wow.
Like the like Bobcat Goldthwait in Police Academy counts as that. Yeah.
Wow.
That's on my list of movies never seen that customers like wanted to fight me over at the video store. Why are you working here when you haven't seen Police Academy?
That'll happen, man. Some people just don't understand how you cannot see certain movies, and we all have those movies.
I had a lot. There was over 50 movies on the list. It went on and on, and I still haven't. I mean, I saw Apocalypse Now. I finally watched Jaws when I was 39.
What'd you think?
I watched it. You know, I was kept away because it was scary. My parents were real strict. No R-rated movies, just because they were good parents. And so I just never, I kind of, in the back of my mind, I know the plot from Mad Magazine, and I didn't think I'd be scared, but I turned off all the lights, watched it by myself, and I was like, I'm really going to give this a chance to scare me. And it didn't. There had no point. And then halfway through, I got kind of bored, and my mind wandered, and I thought, what would scare me? And then I thought of that trailer for the original Dawn of the Dead, which I saw by accident in a theater where they showed up before Blazing Saddles. My parents would take me to R-rated comedies. Like, they didn't care if swearing or nudity.
That was a
whatever.
Double feature?
No. They just showed the preview.
Oh, wow.
And my dad was pissed. He went out and complained to the theater owner.
Yeah.
And I, even thinking about that trailer, I got up, turned all the lights on, watched the rest of Jaws with the lights on because I was so freaked out. Like, even talking about it now, I'm kind of just, that weird synth thing. Yeah. It's just wrong.
It's all kind of warped and weird.
Yeah.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Yeah, so speaking of, there is some gory stuff that comes up right after the chick stuff.
Yeah, but it's the animal. They jump from live animals to dead animals. Mm-hmm. There's no actual death stuff. And none of that It seems strange to me. None of that affected me.
Except for the funeral. There was the, I think, African, South African,
there's,
I don't know.
There's definitely like these really weird shaped coffins that come up. And one, there's a, the guy gets buried in a coffin shaped like a gun.
Double barrel shotgun.
You guys had a, Board Against had a logo that was like the gun that was like, sort of like.
Oh yeah, that was just someone else drew that.
Yeah, but I mean, speaking of like a giant weird gun imagery. Yeah.
That was incredible, especially when you see just the cemetery and then they walk into frame and they're carrying the double barrel shotgun coffin. It's just like, wow.
Yeah, I was actually worried when I worried. I don't know if it's worse or it's just that I thought that a lot of those coffins they showed before, they showed like a little plane, showed like maybe like a race car. I'm like,
yeah,
are these children? Because they just showed like this really sad scene of like children like digging through garbage and stuff.
Yeah.
And it was just like, oh, are these child coffins? And then it's just like, no, it's just a giant gun.
Let's talk about
person inside
the level of expectation in Samsara. Like, what's coming next? Did you guys, when do you remember the first time you saw it and you're like, what could possibly come after this?
Well, when
wait, you mean scene by scene?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, level of expectation that you...
I was looking at... it starts pretty slow with a lot of the nature stuff, which is, like, beautiful, but I'm like, okay, I kind of get it. And then when they show what looks like a baby that's been preserved in formaldehyde, it's sort of, like, a little bit like the 2001 Star Child, and then just, like, the mummified, like, face that is completely, like... dark black, like charcoaled face,
kind of leathery.
I was like, these are just different mummies. But at that point, I'm like, I'm a little bit nervous because the thing that you didn't get this far in Baraka, but there is like a pretty intense scene of, I believe it's in India when they just burn the corpses. So it was just like, oh, I'm just watching. I'm here with my mom in a retirement community watching like an Indian ceremony of a corpse burning.
Right. That's where you watched it?
At Baraka, yeah. It was like in like this theater in a retirement community that my mom lives in.
Nice.
And she's like, well, let's go see this movie. It'll be fun. It's supposed to be really pretty. I'm like, okay. I have a broken leg and I'm staying with my mom, so I have to go to whatever she wants to go to. So that's how I saw Baraka. So when you were like, oh, it's a guy who made Baraka, I'm like, oh boy. It's like the sequel to Baraka. That's crazy. But I didn't realize it was like over the course of 5 years that they shot all this footage.
Right.
And like, it, like 25 countries, that's in the trailer. It's like 5 years, 25 countries.
Right.
And it's, yeah, like just getting all that equipment to all those places and having those really small crews to do all this stuff.
When I read things like that, I just feel like, oh, I'm glad I didn't do that.
Yeah.
And I'll reap the benefits of this other person doing it. You know, the Star Child scene at the end of 2001 was a big influence on Frick. I keep wanting to say Fricky. It's pronounced Frick.
I think it's Frick.
Yeah, let's just say Frick.
Yeah, let's just say
it has more dignity to that. That was a big inspiration for him. I read that in a New York Times article about this. I love 2001, but that whole end when you watch, you're like, what is this shit?
Come on, Kubrick.
And what's weird to me is that I respond very negatively to that kind of stuff in fictional movies. I really don't like things like that. I'll tolerate it if the movie delivers, as 2001 did, but I just don't respond well to ambiguous, beautiful scenes. Mm-hmm. But I do like it in this context. I don't really know why or what the difference is, except that at every single step of the way here, there's effort that's shown. Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of the whiff of cop-out, especially in the end of 2001. But I've seen this in other movies where just things get spacey and nuts. You know what? I kept being reminded of, there's a movie called Calcutta. It was made in 1969 or 1970 by Louis Malle, who did My Dinner with Andre. And it's just him walking around Calcutta with a camera. Mm-hmm. And filming stuff. Same kind of deal. There's people talking in it. There's a whole scene with angry lepers, and they're just pissed off, and they're talking about how shitty it is to be a leper. But it's not. There's no narration, and it's just this guy. And kind of the same thing where I understand how the subjects would be pissed off at being turned into anthropological National Geographic studies. But for me as the viewer, I really enjoyed it and felt somewhat enlightened by it. There were points where this kind of hinted back at that.
There's a couple of things that are intentionally set up, like where it reminded me of like when you see someone, they think they're posing for a still photo, and it's actually a video.
That has to be going on through this movie. There's too many shots like that where people just keep making eye contact, and that's the only way I can think of that he did that.
And they get slightly different credits in the credits for the film, the people that are kind of posed. Like the veteran is
the
one
family
of
with the
family
guns.
With the guns. They have slightly different credits for some of the people. The guy with the robot, the Japanese robot inventor, that is so creepy, but like pretty amazing.
I thought it was hilarious.
Weird inclusion. I thought
it was really funny, and I think one of the things I liked a lot about Baraka and Chrono, which is something we haven't talked about either, but that's Frick as well.
Family, yeah,
is there's a sense of humor involved in these films, I think. Like I feel like there's, like you're saying, with the montage of certain elements that kind of work with and work against each other, I see a certain kind of, like, not exactly a wink, but it's definitely, I feel like, has a sense of humor. With the guy with his robot double, especially.
Yeah, and then they show the sex toys.
The
right
sex
after.
Toys.
Yeah, just clearly.
Yeah.
And then there's that weird interlude with a performance artist that totally doesn't fit in the movie. That is the TV party of this movie. It totally doesn't fit in.
Where did that come from?
It's very, I want to say Matthew Barney-ish. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen, Cream Master?
I thought a little bit Matthew Barney. It reminded me of just like going to any noise show in the last like 20 years.
Yeah. So me and Andy Coronado, who was in the last band that was in Wrangler Brutes, we're going to build this thing that we were going to have play at noise shows because we were so angered. And what it was a giant wooden robot. We really had plans for this that was just going to jerk off in front of the crowd. And we'd be standing behind it with a huge old-timey billows, hand billows, just filled with like ivory dish soap. And so it would just squirt like 9 gallons of just fake robot jizz in the audience. And then that would be our comment on noise bands, just jerking off in front of everyone. Nice. And so that's what this segment is. That's a horrible, horrible thing for me to throw into the middle of your nice G-rated podcast here.
That's fine.
You can take that out.
Fake robot jizz is also the title of my autobiography.
I respond really negatively to people using their public platform to gratify themselves artistically in front of people, as I have done many times in the past and now regret.
It's a podcast.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what it is.
Yeah.
We're gratifying ourselves.
We're explicit on iTunes, so go ahead and say jizz.
We're gratifying ourselves.
But the thing, so let's talk about it for a second, though. Like, it came at a very strange time in the doc. It was around the robots, around the sex, but it was also part of the subway stuff, too, wasn't it? Like, wasn't it also in and around the
I don't totally remember. It's hard to keep track of
to keep track of all that. But where was it? Who was that guy? What was the point?
His name is Olivier Desagazan.
He's a French performance artist.
Oh, do you know Costez? You remember Costez?
No.
Oh, he was like a French noise artist, performance art guy. He was married to Lisa Carver for a while. Yeah, it reminded me of that a little bit too. The French, there's this a whole strain of like pretty intense, weird French stuff. I think people think of it like, when I saw him, I'm like, okay, he's probably German, but when you say he's French, it actually does make sense. There's this sort of weird performance art world there. It's like they really kind of deal with similar themes as. I don't know much about this guy.
Here's my theory.
Artist,
he got into this film because there was some kind of gambling debt Frick owed him. There was a card game that went bad, and the guy's like,
just put me in your
skip
film.
The 18 grand, put me in your movie.
I want to be in your picture.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was startled.
It does not fit at all.
I completely forgot about it, and when I saw it again this afternoon, I was like, oh my God, that's right. I thought he was German, too. It seems so German to me.
It's like for that to happen in the middle of a nonfiction film, like this performance thing,
it seems so.
What he basically does is like he's like putting clay over his face, and he has this total like creepy, like, is it Francis Bacon, those paintings?
Yeah.
Guy? And it's just like, it's like a living Beetlejuice thing is happening. Like a real freaky, and he's just like covering himself. He's like wearing a suit and then just covering himself with clay and then just turning his face into this amorphous, monstrous mass.
So here's the deal. If any of you haven't watched this movie, Samsara, and you're so taken by our conversation today that you do watch it, when that guy comes on, it's not disrespectful to treat that scene like the little cartoon box of popcorn that's walking out and just go to the lobby, a.k.a. your kitchen, get yourself some snacks, come back. If you want to watch it, that's great.
Let's all go to the lobby. You know,
you're not doing yourself any harm, but it's not super intense footage of volcanoes or kids digging through the dump or
it is strange
temples and stupas.
Right, that's a good point. Like it is a first world problem, basically, is what you're watching. It's like, ugh, I have too much grant money. I must put clay on face. And the other thing's like, oh well, we are digging through all your broken computers. Yeah, right. It's like that's what's striking about it. It's like a completely first world problem. Like, oh, we have too many robots. Oh, we have too much clay.
Yeah.
And then it's just like, oh, children are dying, so yeah.
Here's my Matthew Barney question. I've never seen any of those movies. Mm-hmm. Are they worth watching?
Okay, I think the only thing that's available on DVD is part of Cremaster, I want to say 3. It's this thing at the Guggenheim. That's worth watching.
And Agnostic Front and Murphy's Law are in it.
And there's like DVD extras where you see just them playing unplugged, and then you just see people moshing, and you just hear like boots moshing on the ground, and you hear the sound of unplugged electric guitars being strummed, which is the least punk thing. I love that part.
Sounds maybe like something I might watch.
Matthew Barney, I think, is pretty into metal and punk stuff. That's my impression.
What I would like to see is a movie of those guys in the audience watching this movie. and it could be kind of time lapse or something, so you'd see the little smiles during their scenes and then just frowns and scowls during the rest of the
artsy-fartsy movie. It's just stuff like he has, he's wearing like a tartan and he's climbing, he's doing parkour around an art museum.
If he was doing parquet, if it was just the little talking tub of butter. This is a joke for the people my age out there. Yeah. Parquet.
They don't know how to download podcasts. He's doing like parkour, and then there's like his Richard Serra is like melting fat and like letting it run down the whole weird circular Guggenheim.
I totally feel cool with not ever going to, for the rest of my life, and being on my deathbed and not having seen that and just going then dying.
Like, he loves like wax and fat as textures.
Well, hey, who doesn't?
Joseph Beuys thing.
Who doesn't like melting a good block of fat? But you know, wax keep and it to fat. Yourself. Keep it to yourself.
We should do a movie riffing on Cremaster that just goes, it's like a Benson interruption of Cremaster. It's just like a 12-hour movie. Yeah.
George on Acid, we call.
Oh, yeah. We just did Southland Tales. Did you ever watch that at your video store job?
I've heard it's amazingly bad.
It's one of the worst.
Wait, that's with...
it's the guy who made Donnie Darko.
Yeah. I don't like Donnie Darko. Everyone loves it.
I did not like
it. I've given it several chances. My wife really likes it. Mm-hmm. And it's frustrating. You know, there's a whole genre of smart, I'm using that word in air quotes, smart science fiction that just infuriates me. Mm-hmm. Black Mirror, Dark Mirror.
Black Mirror, you don't like Black Mirror?
I can't stand that show.
Okay. Too winky for you?
I am so with you on both of those accounts.
Like, I'm fine with dumb science fiction if it delivers as entertainment. The ultimate example is Minority Report. If you think about Minority Report, mm-hmm. it doesn't make any fucking sense. But it's fine. It's a beautiful movie. Tom Cruise is awesome in it.
And the book is great.
It's really, really well done. Doesn't matter that it doesn't make any sense. And all those things that are in that genre of allegedly smart science fiction just try to make points that aren't real points.
It's pushy.
If you watch Twilight Zone, it's very rare that they try and outsmart the audience. You're with them as they're doing it. And there's something just kind of gross about that genre. And Donnie Darko's part of that. Parts of Donnie Darko you're watching like, yeah, this is going somewhere. It's like you get to the end of Lost and you're like, God damn, it was the fucking mechanical wooden man up on stage jerking off in front of all of us, and we're the joke's on us.
Wooden robot jizz all over the place.
Yeah, I don't want wooden robot jizz on me. No way, man.
This is definitely going into a promo. Like, wooden robot jizz.
Yeah.
Definitely.
But I feel you on both of those fronts. I hate when I feel like I'm being pushed into, like, now watch this. This is weird. I hate weird for weird's sake. And I felt like Donnie Darko was like that. And Black Mirror, I gave it a chance. I was just like, this
I totally
sucks.
Gave it a chance.
Yeah.
I'm going to say Olivier de Sagazan, also in that category.
Haven't seen enough of his oeuvre, so I just don't know.
What if they cast him as Clayface in the new Batman?
Oh,
that would be too much stunt casting.
That would be cool.
But yeah, I think that is interesting. Like, that's a guy who's consciously doing a performance in this film where even the people that are being posed in Samsara, I don't think are like, hey, you know, you're in on you're not
totally out of
it.
Place.
You're not in on it.
Very
where
strange.
This guy's like in on it. It's like, oh, well, let's help your career. So,
right.
You know, all the VA.
I'm just wondering if it's a film technique that they use to get that kind of portrait still feel. Like if they sped up the camera, like if they sped up the frames per second or something.
I see what you're saying. Like those are actually just like.
Because you notice none of them blink ever. Like,
oh, yeah.
They don't blink.
I watch. There's very few blinks. I think it's slightly, well, you can tell. Some of the stuff is slightly slowed down, so there's more time between blinks. And people instinctually will try not to blink when a still photo is being taken. I think that must be what they did.
In the funeral scene, when the cat is lying in the gun casket, the guy, rather, I use cat.
Yeah, you get real jazzy.
I get very jazzy. But everyone is still... No one's blinking except the flowers that the woman's holding is moving, you know, because it's obviously a breeze. So, like, I just feel like it's maybe a manipulation of film speed.
Well, yeah, he's manipulating time a lot in the thing. So I guess if he could do the time lapse, he could do the inverse with it. Yeah.
I wonder what they can do with drones. I mean, I wonder if his next...
You know what? I thought of that while I was watching this.
Oh,
what could this guy be capable of doing with drones? Because I can't imagine you'd be able to hook up a 70mm camera to a drone. It would be too heavy right now. But in the future... Obviously, you'll be able to have some digital simulation of 70mm that can fly around.
What if Frick's next thing is to do 3D, like he's going to do kind of like the Cave of Forgotten Dreams type of situation?
Can they do 3D on a drone?
You could do 3D on a drone, for sure, but like I don't know that would add much. I mean, it would even seem like Cave of Forgotten Dreams, it's weird that it's 3D. I mean, it's like it's dealing with essentially what is... A 2D rendering of
that's
art.
Exactly.
So it's very strange.
Yeah.
That he decided to do that. That ends with a drone. Maybe is what made me think of that.
He kind of
ends it with a drone. I mean, like all the volcano shots and like sulfur mines and things like that would be pretty cool with the drones.
I mean, he got a lot of aerial footage as it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Mecca stuff. You know,
I don't understand how that was done all the notes that I read on this implied that he was present, but you can't go to Mecca unless. You are going to Mecca. Like you can't go there if you're not.
You can't just go set up.
If you're a Muslim,
time lapse camera in front of a thing.
Well, maybe he must have had like a what would that be a secondary crew? Yeah, that went there.
Yeah.
Well, maybe they had flyover licensing or something.
There's a 40-story skyscraper that's right next to the spot.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the Wailing Wall's in there. Then there's Israeli like the wall. Over there.
I went there 4 years ago and I saw people with cameras around. I think everyone's used to that.
You went to Mecca?
No,
you
Jesus.
Went to Israel?
No, went to Jerusalem. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
How was
and
that?
It was okay.
It's like a tourist kind of trip or you had a thing?
No, I wrote an article for Vice. I went there to write about people who suffered from the Jerusalem syndrome.
Right.
Which is this thing when tourists from Western countries show up, occasionally some of them will snap and decide that they are biblical figures and just lose their shit, tear off all their clothes, walk around in bed sheets. Mm-hmm. And so I went there to hunt those people down and did a lot of hard searching and didn't actually find any, but got a decent piece out of it. Mm-hmm. Did a lot of tourist stuff there.
What? So I have never heard of the Jerusalem syndrome before.
Just a thing.
Mark Maron did a whole thing about it also. Like he did, like I think it was the first book or his first one. That
Someone wrote a book, but it's not about this the syndrome itself. It's called the Jerusalem syndrome. Right. Is that Mark Maron? It's a comedian.
Maron did have a book called the Jerusalem syndrome. I thought he does go there and I thought he addresses that in some way, but I've never seen the show.
Yeah.
That was like back, you know, pre-early Mark Maron stuff. Yeah.
When was it first documented? Is this something that's very old? People.
It has been going on since before Israel was a nation.
Right.
Mark Twain, I want to say, wrote about it when he went. It's just one of those things. People have expectations and they come. They don't have to have pre-existing psychological conditions, so it can literally strike anyone. Usually they snap out of it. There's very few people that stay I went to a psychiatric clinic when I was there in a Jerusalem suburb and talked to the main doctor who treats these people. And he says that sometimes they don't snap out. I was surprised that a lot of people, I was asking what the percentages were, assuming that it was mostly Jesus. There were a lot of Jesus's, Jesus, mm-hmm. John the Baptist, Mary's. A lot of people decide that they're the devil.
Oh.
But it goes down. There's a hierarchy. I don't remember what it is now. There's a lot of... I mean, if you've spent any time in New York City, you're used to crazy people. Richmond, Virginia had a really big population of insane people. There were theories just that they were busting from other parts of the South. Mm-hmm. So you're not getting a really weird feel. There's just crazy street people yelling stuff. I passed a bunch of full-on dudes with megaphones on Hollywood Boulevard to get here today, and it's just that these people, once you dip into their stories, there's more of a common theme, and a lot of them were people that just came there on holiday and snapped. You get that also. There's one corollary to it. There's the Paris syndrome, and that is specifically, supposedly, Japanese people go to Paris and lose their shit. But it's different. You don't have expectations. Like, I don't know, they get a beret and a little striped shirt and a baguette and walk around.
Start doing performance art?
Yeah, I don't know what exactly happens.
But that's specific to Japanese people?
Yeah, supposedly.
Wow. I've heard that one.
Yeah. That's not as big a deal. Yeah. Paris syndrome is not as big a deal, and I don't think manifests itself in as fun a way, or for me, as sellable a way, mm-hmm. Journalistically. Wow. Yeah, one of those weird things.
That is very strange.
Is there anything that you have in the pipeline that's going to be coming out in the next couple months that you
nothing.
Want to talk about?
No, nothing. I have a lot of projects in the works.
And other stuff. Where else have you been writing for? Apology?
I have a piece that should be out on Mental Floss soon, but I don't know. I don't know what's going on. Yeah, I have a short story coming out in Apology 4, which is going to be out sometime in summer of 2015. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I have stuff. I get asked a lot, and I'm a working freelance writer, which means I deal with a shitload of rejection, which means I frequently don't know what to say when I, you know, like, I hope I have stuff coming out, right. But I got a lot of rejection letters, so
yeah,
I don't know.
I think the Doc Dart thing was like kind of your first bigger piece, right, that you did anywhere?
Yeah, I had done a column for Punk Planet, and I did this piece on the end of Alberti Records, which was a pressing plant that went bankrupt in 2001, Alberti. Right after 9/11, and I went there, and I sort of took a stab at writing about that world in a different style than I had before. I'd been really inspired by an excerpt of, was it Brendan Mullen's book on the germs that appeared in the LA Weekly, which was this really interesting take on that kind of story where it wasn't just shitty hagiography, just writing about how awesome the germs were. And it was just a good history that wasn't lazy. It wasn't an oral history, which is what that book turned into. Mm-hmm. It was just solid journalistic writing, and I thought it would be neat to write something in that style. And I think that influenced the Alberti piece. It might have come after that, but either way, in between that piece, which was 2001, and the Doc Dart thing, which I wrote in 2007, I remember thinking it would be really neat to write about this guy, Doc Dart, who later changed his name to 26, the number. Mm-hmm. And it would be neat to try to do it in that style. And for years, I thought, I hope somebody writes that. And then one day the light bulb went off, like, oh, I should write that. Yeah. And then I did that. And that's probably the high point of my journalistic career. That piece is a really solid piece. I'm conscious of the fact I've got some duds out there, but that piece like worked.
Well, you did a lot of research on that, I remember. Actually, in terms of, like, we could also talk about nonfiction, creative nonfiction as a form of documentary in itself. Like, are there people that influence you in that form of writing? Like, I personally like Joan Didion a lot. I don't know if that's...
You know, I'm not well enough read a person yet, so I feel like I can't answer that. I mean, I've only read one Joan Didion book. I read the her second to last one about her grief and her husband. The writing's really solid, obviously, but it also struck me as being kind of strange and self-indulgent. And I know right now when I'm hit with a direct hit, either grief-wise or disease-wise, I just don't think I would be impelled to write about it. I've read a lot about death writing. I mean, I'm kind of curious to read Christopher Hitchens' book about dying of cancer, but what can be said about it? You know, it's like a spoiler alert. Like, I'm going to be facing this shit. Don't, you know, ruin it for me, guys. Like, I'm going to go through this myself. Yeah. These are such universal things. It seems like it's really, you've got an uphill battle writing about grief, loss, disease. We're all going to go through it. I don't know that I would ever be moved to write about those things. What was the point of that? Oh, Joan Didion. Yeah, I don't know enough. I'm not there yet. I was a lazy reader for years and years, and I'm not now, but I got a long list. Mm-hmm. I only just read, like, probably my second Mark Twain book earlier this year. I just read Naked Lunch last month. Mm-hmm. God, that was a chore. And I brought it into a cafe in Mendocino. I was up there visiting some family. And the woman behind the coffee shop, the register, the barista says, oh, what do you got? And I've got it, like, turned spine backwards so no one can read, because I'm embarrassed. And I said, oh, just a book I'm embarrassed to read. And finally, she kind of shames me into showing it to her. And I'm like, Naked Lunch. Instead of saying, oh, are you 15 years old, jerk? Instead, she says, oh, that's one of my favorite books. I'm like, And then, because they always blast music at this cafe, I said, oh, do people read a lot here? Meaning in that cafe. And instead, she took it, I think, to mean in Mendocino. Like, I'm total city slicker. Like, ah, do people read in this town, lady? I didn't know. And so then I had to hide my face. Every other day, I came into that cafe. God, I felt like an asshole.
You start bringing in Judy Blume. Like, each time you come in, the book gets less and less significant. So when you guys, like, watch Samsara, I'm just curious, like, when you know, there's the Japanese woman in the traditional Japanese dancing, you know, with the little tear coming down. You remember that?
Yeah, that's right.
That was, I thought, very odd as well. I didn't know if that was like...
That's not Buto. It's maybe... Buto's a different thing, but yeah, it's like a... I don't know what you call that makeup thing that you...
I'm going to say the wrong word. I have an idea, but I don't know, and I don't...
I'm afraid...
I don't want to look like an idiot in this podcast, so...
I don't know either.
Words,
yeah.
No.
The clown? G-word. Clown face?
I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know.
Whoa. Hey.
Wait a second. I don't know it either, other than, like...
why is she crying? Is that the question?
No, yeah. Like, why is she...
I
want to
say kabuki makeup, but I don't think that's kabuki.
Oh, yeah, I think that's closer than what
I was
gonna
I don't know.
Say.
It's just, she's in a geisha outfit, and she sheds a single tear, and it's a weird thing. I like the fact that all that is presented without context. I don't know what the meaning is or why that was in there, but...
What about the Indonesian prison dancing? That, like, sort of flash mob sync dance.
Was it Indonesia?
Was it either China or...
I thought
or
it was the Philippines.
That might have been the Philippines.
It can't be China, because I just can't imagine a prison in China being that...
That cool?
Yeah, that happy a place.
Well, I think it's Philippines, because then they then released them doing Michael Jackson.
Right.
Thriller, I believe. Yeah, they were doing the synchronized...
Another, like, fun... Let's put a fun face on the prison complex. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, that's also... There's so much, yes, presented without actual context, and that's the point of it is just to just blast you in a way. But I guess the idea that it's a guided meditation, or I think the ultimate thing, if you're going to go back to the framing piece of, like, we made this intricate art and then we just sandblasted it, it's just like, it's supposed to be like, just give up on attachment to things. Maybe even about death and life, just like, it's just a cycle you're going to go through.
It's like that old Bill Hicks sketch. Oh, you thought that things mattered. Oops, nothing matters. Yeah. Guess what?
Did you guys, at the end of it, feel enlightened? Did you feel depressed? Were you happy?
When I saw it in Monument Valley.
You were happy.
Yeah, I felt very enlightened.
Yeah. Did you have anything to drink as well when you watched that, or just straight Vicodin?
No, I can't really drink. I didn't drink as a young person. Mm-hmm. And even if I wanted to, I have had drinks. I actually had my first and only hangover a couple months ago. Someone made me two White Russians, and I watched Jeepers Creepers 2. And I enjoyed it, but I don't...
The school bus, yeah.
Yeah, I don't have any tolerance for alcohol. I don't enjoy it.
Okay.
And it's... For whatever reason, my limited experience in opiates has been a lot more pleasant.
Right, so after watching it in Monument Valley, you were like, this is amazing. I want to see this again.
And also, I wish I could fly.
Oh, right.
And I want to make movies.
Yeah.
And I want to wake up every other person, every other cabin, and just explain them that I love them and I love the universe. Yeah. And I'm happy we're all people here on this on Spaceship Earth.
Have you met, there was some scenes in there that actually, I think there was some stuff that I want to say it was like New Orleans stuff. There was,
yeah, there's some post-Katrina stuff, right?
Post-Katrina stuff. That really got to me too.
It's very haunting.
That reminded me of, there's another person who's like a noise musician, Susie Pauling, who's a great photographer, who had these great photos of these abandoned hospitals in like Michigan. They're like, you know, like old, like, where like all the files are flown everywhere, and then there was just like ivy creeping up the walls. Some of that stuff reminded me of that, but like the Katrina stuff was real brutal because there's no person for the first chunk. There's other than the monks, you don't see people for a
right,
while.
Right,
you just have scenery.
Yeah,
and that's one of those ones where it's like, and I was like piecing together. I'm like, oh, this is totally Katrina damage.
Again, a lot of these things could be cheap shots. I subscribe to a lot of Twitter feeds and Instagram feeds that are National Geographic-y, or they are National Geographic, or they're vacation shots, and it's not travel porn, but it's all the same shit you've seen over and over again. It's Bora Bora, mm-hmm. and Petra, and Horseshoe Bend, and the Colorado River. And so one of the things that struck me about the cinematography in this movie is that this could easily have been that, and it's not.
Yeah.
It's not a cheap shot if you go far enough into it. And I feel that way in a variety of levels in different mediums. If you're doing, like we're talking about, Minority Report, it doesn't matter if it doesn't make sense as long as it delivers as a movie. And I will watch comedy that's really distasteful. I can put up with a lot of really shitty, non-PC, racist humor, 9/11 jokes if they deliver. Then there's something there where you can be bummed, but at least there is a point comedically, this person is crossing those lines for a purpose. And nothing infuriates me more when people make really dumb jokes that are, you know, hey, some ethnic humor, and it's just shitty.
Yeah,
you know?
What's the point?
Well, he
has the ability to deliver on an emotional basis, kind of like Errol Morris. We were talking about Errol Morris the other day, and he has the ability to take what seems like inconsequential, boring topics, and makes them extremely palatable.
I have never seen an Errol Morris movie, so all that stuff's going to go on my list.
You should.
And there's stuff in this that reminded me of Fast Cheap about and Out of Control, maybe because I was watching them around the same time. But like these sort of big, overreaching topics about like life and like the finitude of human endeavor.
Right.
One thing I wanted to touch on, because Philip Glass is so integral with Quentin Scotzi, is and he's done this with Baraka too, and I was never a big Dead Can Dance fan, but it's like Lisa Gerrard.
Yeah, she's one of the two soundtrack people. Yeah, so that goes hand in hand with hippie bullshit, which is a huge, like, that covers a lot of ground for me. I don't like, I'm not a big fan of Dead Can Dance. I really don't like fake Dead Can Dance-y stuff, and that's what struck me here. I totally am completely fine with all the music in this movie because it's in the service of something that delivers.
Yeah.
Same deal. Just make it deliver. You could play Grateful Dead, play Korn, whatever. Like, if it's for something...
Mm-hmm.
For something where it works, like, God bless you, you know?
I think there's sort of a lot of, like, tabla and stuff where it's like, oh, this is like, oh, this is weird because it already feels like a weird fake anthropological thing.
It's what it is the stand at any Target department store where they have the 30 CDs where it's playing relaxing music, and you just pass by it because you're there to buy some tube socks, and you're like, ah, you hear that.
There's a lot of choral.
But that's because you're at Target.
Yeah.
And you're not watching this beautiful movie. And I was completely fine with all of this.
Here's an experiment I did this afternoon. I turned the sound off for almost half the second half of the film. And it still held up. And so I guess to your point, it's like, you know, you don't even have to really hear the music to be moved by the...
Well, the real test is you play Yakety Sax over it, which we were going to do last night. It was late, and I was tired.
So did you watch it with...
That's the best.
A friend of ours who is our roommate for the
Hunting, Yakety Sax makes everything better.
There's nothing that... It's messed up. You can't buy Yakety Sax as either a ringtone or as a song, because...
Oh, you can buy it as a song on iTunes, I have.
No shit. I tried.
Boots Randolph version? Maybe it was a while ago. Maybe the licensing got taken away. What if you just made an own Pandora station of Yakety Sax?
Here's an amazing idea that I had that other people should do, and I'm going to do it. You buy Yakety Sax, which now I know you can do. Originally it was you get a CD of it or something. you get some bitchin' stereo system for your vehicle, your truck, whatever. You go to one of these protests. We thought about it for the protests in Temecula, the anti-immigration protests, where these assholes drove down and were picketing little kids who are, they're already in detention centers.
Horrible.
You show up and you just blast Yakety Sax on loop, stand there, give everyone the finger, and don't leave.
Yeah.
That's how amazing would that be?
That would
just
be amazing.
Just disarmingly amazing.
Well, we usually end this, Sam. I ask people about the first documentary they saw, a documentary that was very significant to them, or a documentary that got them into watching documentaries. I know we kind of covered that at the beginning.
Chris Marker.
Yeah.
And
I really love Sans Soleil, and I can watch it over and over again and get something out of it. It's very dense. I really like density in literature and in movies. I love Blade Runner because you can... everyone loves Blade Runner. It feels stupid to even say. But one of the reasons I love it is because you can watch it over and over and just see shit. Like, visually, it's just really dense. That's what Sans Soleil is. Totally get it if other people don't like it.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Sam.
Hey.
Read your Repo Man liner notes.
Yeah.
Did you talk to Alex Cox for that at all? Or?
I didn't. I talked to him once before. Uh-huh. I interviewed him for the Village Voice.
Yeah, how was that?
That was great. That was really, really good. He has a very mixed reputation as someone to deal with. I've heard some real horror stories about him. And God damn, he was a gentleman. And really just wanted to talk about cool stuff. Did not care for Escape from New York, which disappointed me. But in every other respect, was just a real sweetheart to deal with. His movies after those first four are very different. Mm-hmm. There's some I still need to see. There's one that he shot in Mexico right after Straight to Hell that I've been trying to find. Highway Patrolman, I think maybe it's called.
Yeah, he had this whole Mexican era that I didn't see. I didn't see any
of Repo Chick is a bummer.
Oh, I don't even want to watch it. It's like the S. Darko of the Repo Man universe.
It's
right?
a bummer.
It's Babe in the City too.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, if you've done Repo Man, you're Neil Armstrong. You could spend the rest of your life walking around in the bathrobe, going to the grocery store, drinking orange juice off the shelf and just throwing the carton down the aisle and punching little kids in the
face.
That's
what Harry Dean Stanton's been doing for the last 3 years.
That's great. I saw Harry Dean Stanton at the premiere of, what's his doc? Is the movie about him?
Yeah, they just did one about him.
That's it's really great.
Which I don't remember the title. And he heckled his own movie. During it, in the middle of it, he yells out, "Bullshit!"
Nice.
And it was him. It was awesome.
Did you like that one?
It was. I don't think it's an amazing movie, but I enjoyed it thoroughly.
He's a great character.
It doesn't. It's felt a little lazy, but who cares? It's him, and he's singing, and it was awesome, and it was really great. Going to it and seeing him there.
Well, thanks, Sam. Appreciate
it. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for listening. And you can find episodes of SupDoc on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Please subscribe, review, and rate.
Please follow us on Twitter at SupDocPodcast and online at SupDocPodcast.com.
This show is produced by Will Scovel.
Theme music is by David Siegel.
If you want to suggest a documentary or a future guest, please email us at SupDocPodcast@gmail.com.